Let's open up to some questions. We got a talented group of people up here. Who's got some thoughts? David.
Well, it's kind of for Jeff and Steve. Could you give us a sense of how North Carolina ranks nationally in terms of policies, in terms of programs like Cures? Are we on the leading edge? Are we in the middle of the pack? Sort of trailing behind?
I'll answer a little of that, and then I'll let Steve handle more of the policy side. But I can tell you from one standpoint, there is something that we're very proud of with our program, is that NC Green Power is the first program in the nation to involve multiple electric utilities working together to offer this to their customers. We have 40 electric utilities in our program that offer this renewable energy to their customers. And it may not seem like a big thing, but it really is when you consider that in many respects, electric utilities have kind of been these little autonomous islands that have done their little thing and stay within their group. And this program has allowed a lot of cross-utility cooperation and then bringing those together with environmental groups and policy groups, and it's something that's never really happened before. And so a lot of states look at how we're doing it and say, you know, that's a unique model, and there's a lot of eyes on us to see how successful we are. One of the things that I was going to mention before that I'll just throw in here, and then I'll pass it off to Steve, is you know, the policy is one part of that puzzle. It's an essential part of that puzzle. But at some point, then the consumer has to take it and do something with it. And that's one of the things that NC Green Power really is about, is making the consumer realize not only where your energy comes from, but that you have choices of where we can have it coming from in the future. And so I think, you know, when you were speaking earlier about how, you know, the support system went away and we were left in the vacuum there for several years, there's always a fear that I have that if the current things that are driving us towards being interested in renewable energy ever lessened or went away, would we still care? And I think it's very, very important that you take up that torch, and that we all do, and make sure that people know that these options are important, that it's not just a trend right now. Gas prices are high, therefore we need to buy hybrid cars. You know, energy prices are high, therefore we need to consider renewables. It needs to be an ongoing thing that has to take hold in the community, or it's never going to work. And so the uniqueness of having a multi-utility program is that the NC Green Power has 4.5 million ratepayers out there that can support renewable energy. And we've seen consumer-driven change work in the sense of, I think we see it with compact fluorescent light bulbs, with Energy Star appliances, with hybrid vehicles. And you're always going to have people starting out with new things. You know, one of the challenges with renewable energy right now is it's very expensive, because it's not being produced yet on the scale of a coal plant or things like that. And so we have that challenge at NC Green Power to help work in a world that would say, well, why do I want to pay extra on my power bill to support renewable energy? Why should that matter to me? Shouldn't the power company take care of that? It's kind of it's not my fault, it's not my responsibility kind of thing. And I think that we can continue in that vein, or we can begin to take some personal responsibility and say, we are going to have to make some individual choices, and we're going to have to help others make those choices as well. So from the standpoint of what's interesting about our state and our program, I think there's a lot of merit to be said for the consumer-driven program, because it does enhance other efforts, policy efforts, to really drive that home. Because if we don't, the change isn't going to be permanent. And I think that we have to be very conscious of that. So pass on down, Steve.
Let me follow on to the NC Green Power discussion. Let me clarify for the record, I'm actually a board member of NC Green Power. I represent Solar Technologies on that board, and I'm pleased and proud to do so. I think that NC Green Power has been a leadership program for the Southeast, certainly, and for much of the country in the way that it's set up. And it's also been a leadership program for the state, because it's really opened the door to a lot of other discussions where we were falling behind as a state, and we were having real struggles getting North Carolina to look at the same issues that other parts of the country were looking at. Net metering, interconnection technology, figuring out how you hook these systems up to the utility grid. You know, those are discussions that we couldn't have had in this state had it not been for NC Green Power bringing the utilities to the table to talk about these technologies in a forum where we could all have a discussion. Because prior to that, it was really environmentalists on one side and utilities on the other side, and you're doing this, and nothing was really happening. And, you know, a program like NC Green Power has been instrumental in bringing everybody to the table to have a discussion, which has now led to, you know, the utilities coming out with their own proposal for a renewable portfolio standard in the state. And NC Green Power would continue to exist on top of that. For basically, you know, NC Renewable Portfolio Standard becomes the baseline, and NC Green Power becomes those of you who want to do even more, sign up and do even more. Yeah. You know, so there's a real progression. Now that said, North Carolina, we're the laggards, you know, compared to much of the rest of the country. You know, I saw a recent study, energy efficiency investment by electric utilities. We ranked 46th, I believe it was, in the country. We in terms of renewables implementation, we were not really measurable prior to NC Green Power, and we're still not huge. 53 systems is a week's work in California. It's a year's work here. We've still got a long way to go. But, you know, like I said, the General Assembly is hopping right now on these policy issues to move us forward, and we're going to become a leader in the country, and certainly in the Southeast, to moving all of this forward. So I'm excited about it right now.
John?
I have a question actually for Bill. That is, with your thoughts about the structure of the biofuels industry and how it will develop, the current industry for transportation fuels is pretty capital intensive, very concentrated to the producer process part of that.
That's right.
Is there anything inherent in the biofuels industry that would drive us towards that same sort of concentration, or would we expect to see an industry that might be
I think initially it's going to have to be fragmented. You're not going to have Baytown, Texas, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You're not going to have Newark, New Jersey, Elizabeth, New Jersey. They're not going to be these focal points where you have these giant trunk lines coming out of the Gulf of Mexico feeding the nation. I don't think that's going to be a plausible model for the very reasons you suggest. The capital expense is enormous. So it's going to be a niche industry. It is not going to be a major supplier of our needs. It'll be a component of many technologies. I think it, optimistically, if we can get 5% biofuels out there, you know, providing energy for our vehicles, that'll be a significant accomplishment. And I'm not certain whether I can be optimistic enough to say we're going to have a whole lot more than that. But at the same token, many other newly emerging technologies, both in hybrids, plug-in hybrids, is going to be phenomenal. The new engines that GM has developed, which are basically an electric generator, a very small diesel engine, whose sole purpose is not to drive the wheels, it's just to provide electricity to the batteries. They have now new battery technology, which is fairly light, very powerful, and very efficient electric motors. You mostly want to drive the car and not make heat. That's basically what you're hopeful for an electric motor. And that technology is not too far down the road. And, you know, so if you provide small, efficient vehicles, people, change habits a little bit. You know, if we really, really need to go 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, you know, I think we need to change that a little bit. That mentality is not wise. Grocery store in my SUV to get a bottle of milk is not a wise decision. So, in my travels, which I do get to travel quite a bit, recruiting students from Europe, you know, I see a whole different model over there, and it's financially driven. It's very expensive to drive in Europe, and yet you see people commuting very efficiently and driving smaller cars. Diesel has a much larger presence there. Diesel is not without problems, but if you use newer fuels, cleaner fuels, supplement with biodiesel, I think it's going to be a very viable technology that's going to make a lot of people a lot of money if they're in the right place. This is the place where a smart MBA student in this sector, in the fuel sector, either fuels or batteries, I would predict, you know, there's this old movie, you don't even remember it, The Graduate, where the father says plastics to his son-in-law, plastics. And he was right. And then all of a sudden, the plastics industry took off? Well, I'm telling you right now, batteries or fuel, you're going to make a mint, and you're going to do an important function in making a lot of money. You're going to make our air better, our health is going to improve, and many other things are going to go better. And I didn't want to get into any of this discussion, but security is a major issue. So when you when you're pumping your $250, $280 a gallon gasoline, that's a false $2.80 that you're pumping into your car. That's supplemented by a lot of other issues. So, but that's for another time, another conversation. And obviously, you already now you know my political leanings right now. So,
it's a valid point. I mean, if you look at what's going on around the world in terms of oil production, whether you believe there's an end to oil in some of these fun folks are out there talking about or not, the places we're getting the oil aren't exactly fun places for vacations. And it's whether it's Venezuela, where we're pretty much burned in effigy, or it's Saudi Arabia, where there's a monarchy that's quasi-stable, or it's Russia, which decides to turn off the tap periodically just for just grins.
Yeah.
There's a lot of places out there that are, you know, supplying the infrastructure for what we're, or the fuel for the infrastructure that we've got. And I think it's a very good point. The biodiesel industry, you know, is really, I think, likely to be a locally driven industry. I think that just, I mean, the strategic plan for biofuels development in North Carolina talks about the possibility of a biofuels or a biodiesel refining situation in every county in the state for economic development purposes. It's an industry that's much more so than ethanol, I think, oriented toward local development. Ethanol, I think there's a lot to be said for economies of scale.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think biodiesel lends itself very well to grassroots infrastructure and rural economic development models.
I just want to add to your sort of energy security local stuff. You know, same thing with renewable energy as well. When some economic models of the thing, the reality is just the processing can't be that far from the source. So, I mean, in some cases, when we deal with biomass like wood waste or animal waste, methane, and things like that, you just simply can't process it with current technology very far from where it comes from, or the economics just go out the door. But the other thing is, you know, we talk about foreign security, but yet, you could even point to Hurricane Katrina and things that happen locally, domestic disasters, interruptions. Any of you that appreciate military logistics and history, the longer your supply line, the harder it is to maintain your army. Well, the same thing's true for day-to-day operations. When we're relying on fuel sources, whether it be petroleum or whether it be coal from Pennsylvania, West Virginia, you know, Wyoming, those kind of places, the further our fuel sources are away, the more potential jeopardy we could be in. So in some respects, you could almost envision renewable energy one day, while you still have to achieve a scale to where it becomes economical, you could almost envision generation of renewable energy being not unlike the internet, in that there's enough generation sites all around that it would be very hard to bring down the entire infrastructure.
In 2003, one tree limb took down the utility grid of the entire northeastern portion of the United States, if you recall that. And some of those places didn't get power back for 2 weeks. You know, that's not good model in the current era of uncertainty that we have about security on a lot of fronts. And if you happen to be running a manufacturing plant that's dependent on electric power on a constant basis in order to maintain quality control, you lost a whole hell of a lot of money if you were sitting in one of those places that went down for 2 weeks. You may have even lost a whole hell of a lot of money if you were in a place that went down for an hour.
Yep.
And so, you know, those kinds of issues are the things that lead us to decentralize power generation, decentralize fuel production, and you know, move us in a direction that's really a different paradigm from where we are today. But that the technology's there for. We just need to figure out how to move the policy framework and the market framework to get us there.
Yep. Yeah. I think we got enough time for one more question. Yes.
Jeff, I saw on the NC Green Power website that there was a, last fall, you had a period where there was a request for proposals for, I guess, forgive me, I don't remember the terminology, but not the individual producers, but the next step up.
Right, you mean like landfill gas or something like that?
Not specific, I don't
Larger generation, is that what you're saying, like size-wise, capacity-wise?
Yes, and I was wondering what kind of response you had to that and how many are accepted and that sort of thing.
That's a good question. We do. We have a couple different ways we accept producers into our program, and one of the methods is if you are a solar or wind generator of a 10 kW or under capacity, 10 kilowatt, the average home, 2 to 4, somewhere in there, so 10 is a fairly good size for a small system. If you're 10 kW and under, you can join our program at any time if you're a solar or wind producer. If you are larger than that or another resource like landfill methane gas or small hydroelectric or biomass, you have to go through what we call a request for proposals process. And the reason we have that process historically has been because we are a customer-driven program. We can't bring on the renewable energy without the financial support of our participants. So as we bring on more participation and we need more energy, we send out a request for proposals. And we invite people to bid in with their projects. And we get, depending on what we're asking for, the one in the fall was a general request, so it was for any resource that was qualifying. We get a variety of different things. We typically get multiple landfill methane gas proposals because there are businesses out there that have made, you know, their living off developing these projects, so it's a pretty common thing. We sometimes get biomass. I think that's going to start increasing over time. I think it's a newer field, so you don't get as much. And we do get wind. We've gotten several recent winds. And usually we get a lot of small hydro. That is the last particular one we didn't get that many. We had somebody ask, why don't you have more hydro in the program? I said, well, actually, we didn't have that many bid in the last time. So, but other times they have. So it depends on what is available at the time. We do have a resource mix that we aim for, and that's based on the costs of what we're paying as far as the extra incentives to these producers. So if solar being one of the, and wind being a little more of the premium products in the sense of that they cost a little more to produce than methane, so we balance that out to where we get a 4 cent per kilowatt hour average, which is where your $4 per 100 kilowatt hours goes. But of those, we evaluate each proposal based on, number one, is it feasible? Well, we get a lot of folks that bid in proposals that they sound really good, but it's just impossible to do.
Launched by many MBA students, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Or they have a very bad business plan. We see some that just kind of comes in on a piece of paper, and it's like, hey, I want to put in a biomass generation on my farm. And I'm like, well, have you thought about it? But in some cases, it has to do with timetables. We've had folks that have very good projects that just aren't, they're not going to be online in time. We try to aim for around 6 months from the time that an individual contributes to our program to the time that contribution has been generated. We like it sometimes to be even better, but 6 months is the average. So we really don't want to bring on a project that's going to take 2 or 3 years to get online. But we do tell them, come back, you know, when you got it a little further along. It is important, and it is something that is essential because some of these projects, it takes a lot of capital funding to get them up, and so they come to us looking for, you know, are we going to be in your program? And sometimes they do that before they're ready, simply because it doesn't make a lot of prudent sense to invest so much in the project if nobody's going to buy it from you.
All right. Well, thanks to all the people on the panel that have helped to clarify something.
You weren't here, you didn't see, you get a special present.
Oh, wow. Yes. Oops. Gifts are good.
Yes. We don't let you leave without taking a little token of our appreciation.
Thank you.
Very happy to do it. Yes. Thank you for hosting us.
I would have done it without the gift.
Yeah.
But see, that's the signature of MBA.
That's right. That's the successful MBA student.
I will note that, just as a closing comment, that anybody else that's looking for internship work should get up with Henry, because we're always looking for additional interns, and if we don't have a project, we can probably invent one. We've got lots and lots of work to do in the state, so come talk to us, because we're always happy to talk to students about student-based work.
And those of you that are in other departments, I encourage you to maybe take this as a model and maybe host your own conference. You know, I think this would be a marvelous topic for the design school and the School of Architecture to take up. I would love to hear their spin on this whole idea of green roofs and alternate building technologies. And, you know, that's the beauty of this world, is so diverse. I'd just love to just keep getting feedback from lots of different perspectives. So take it home and plant a bug in your department's ear.
And you know, you guys are it sounds very contrived, but Steve and several people have alluded to it. You really are the future. And to use a moderately R.J. Reynolds approach to people, if we can cultivate you to think about these technologies as being the norm instead of being alternatives, and really push when you're in the business sector, when you can make a difference, because there's a lot of people out there that are just fine doing things the way they've always done it, and helping create that need is going to be one of the most important missions you'll do as students, I think. So,
I want to thank these guys again. Give them another round of applause. Of course, I want to thank you guys for coming out. I'm really pleased to see so many new faces. You know, I have the regulars that, you know, the NC State guys that I see, but it really is a, like I said, a great thing for our chapter, like I said, in our second year, for us to be doing this for the first time, to see, you know, everybody come out today and enjoy the conference. So, you know, like I said, I think we've learned a lot, we've shared a lot, we've increased our networks, which is a, you know, key MBA, you know, term I thought there.
How can I get to be a member of Night Impact?
Well, Derek, it's good that you asked. that's actually a good point. What I really want for you guys to do, so far as the NC State chapter, you can go to our website, www.mbasa.org/netimpact, and it's in the folders. You guys can go there, find out more about our chapter, and then also go ahead and find out about Net Impact as a whole. And the Net Impact website is netimpact.org. If you guys want to get in contact with us at any time, very simple email, ncstatenetimpact@gmail.com. So you can shoot us an email about anything, and we really want to make sure that, like I said, we are a source, particularly for the Raleigh area, for different things like this, whether it be environmental, social, or, you know, how to bring it all together. So again, I want to thank our board for the hard work that we've all done, like I said, and thanks again.